BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect. We're coming to you from the Bristol Radio Co-op Studios in Queen Square in Bristol. And hello Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, South America, and all those accessing the show across the world via the internet. Our studio guest this week is writer and researcher, art and literature, history and music researcher, Brian Grist, and he's here to answer our questions thrown at him. Quite a challenge. And we also have part three of our feature on 21st century espionage. Anthea Page reports on the 175th anniversary celebrations of the Tolpuddle Martyrs and interviews Tony Benn and Ben Bradshaw down at the Tolpuddle Festival in Dorset last Sunday. Malcolm Greaves reads another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, which is set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. Rounding it all off, Jeff Sparks is back to bring us the very latest What's On in Bristol. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome now to Brian Grist. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Now, you are a researcher. You're obviously into art, literature, history and music. But let's start off by talking about the Banksy exhibition.
Yep.
Because you've visited it a couple of times. Many people have also visited it as well. But you've got a little tip, haven't you, for a way of visiting it without having to queue.
Well, this is only if not very many people take up this tip, because it won't work if everybody does the same thing. But the trick is just to get there around about 10 to 15 minutes after they open the doors. And that allows the time for the queue that's been waiting to get in. And then there's quite often, not every day, but quite often, a little gap where you can just walk in.
There's been some incredible queues.
Which I've done twice.
There's been some incredible queues here, haven't there, especially at the weekends?
Quite breathtaking, actually, some of them. The one I saw last Saturday stretched all the way down to the Bristol Royal Infirmary, and that's a very, very long queue.
Yeah, it must be thousands of people waiting to get in.
I do know somebody who was in that queue and waited 3 hours.
Well, anyway, what about, can we have a little review of the exhibition from you? What were your impressions?
I think it's a very, very important and impressive show. Possibly significance that it's not going to be seen just yet, but will reverberate as the years go by. It's a very, very important show and a great, great privilege for Bristol to be hosting it. So it's hats off to the museum for being that daring.
Now, I know there's a lot of graffiti artists, some from Bristol, who have actually made it really into the big time, doing work for things like computer games companies, etc.
Indeed.
What do you think it is that singles Banksy out?
His wit, his sophistication of his humour, which is sharper than anybody else's working in that area. And his uncanny ability to place the right image in the right place at the right time.
But it is actually just stuff sprayed up on a wall, isn't it? Why is
it
that you think...
No,
well,
no, it isn't.
Well, to begin with, this was what Banksy was doing, wasn't it? He
was always working from stencils when he started. And then he pioneered the use of the stencil, which is obviously a very different thing than just spraying against a wall.
This isn't conventional art, though, is it?
It depends what you mean by conventional. Now, what do you mean?
Well, a picture which is sort of painted on a canvas and then hung up on the wall.
It has more in spirit with the art movement called Dada, which, as you probably know, emerged out of the First World War. So Banksy's, there are historical precedents for what Banksy's doing.
Do you think there's an underlying message behind the wit and the humour and the sort of subject matter that Banksy approaches?
Yeah, I think he's challenging the way we think about things. And that's the message of most decent artists, actually. They will challenge the way you see things. And in Banksy, there's the immediate challenge of where you expect to see an artistic statement. Do you expect it to see it on somebody's suburban wall? No. Do you expect it to see it on the side of a boat? No. So he's challenging where you are actually going to perceive art outside of the museum culture that we've been living in since the Second World War.
Now, I visit London from time to time, and in Shoreditch, there was a very memorable Banksy, which was right across the bridge at Shoreditch in North London. A line of American soldiers, sort of repetitive line, all each one stenciled separately, and then "Have a nice day" written across underneath it. And that was literally painted over by, I think it was by Railtrack, because they were just doing routine painting. Now, do you think that's vandalism?
What, the painting over of the Banksy?
Painting over of the
artwork.
Well,
interestingly enough, there's one of the exhibits in the current show in Bristol actually does comment on this, and it features a painting by Damien Hirst, one of his spot paintings. And the interesting thing about it is that what Banksy's done is he's put a monkey painting out Damien Hirst's painting on there, which is itself a kind of inverted comment on, look, is this vandalism or not? Or is it actually making a statement? And I think different people have different opinions. Most of the people who think it is vandalism, and I will agree that a lot of graffiti art is vandalism, but property owners have a huge voice in this. And there used to be a big debate, particularly in some areas of Bristol, particularly Eastern, where corporate vandalism was more or less accepted until people like Banksy started challenging the placing of huge advertising hoardings in spaces where the community had no say in it.
So is it just a matter of personal opinion whether you see piece of stencil art as vandalism against the wall, or whether actually painting over it will be vandalism? Is that just a personal
I think
opinion?
It starts off at that way, but in all art, a consensus begins to grow. And a consensus isn't immediate, it begins to develop. And interestingly, the consensus on Banksy has changed so radically in the last 4 years. He's gone from enfant terrible to the toast of the artistic world at the moment.
Do you think the influence on youngsters is a good thing, to get young people emulating Banksy?
To emulate the content of his work, yes.
Okay.
But I don't think many people have got the wit and the charm that he has in his work to pull it off. And many people have tried and are not succeeding.
I'm still a little mystified with the link with Dada. Can you just, for those of the people that have never come across Dada, can you just give us a brief brush of what that is?
Yeah, Dada was a school of art formed in Zurich in Switzerland in approximately 1916. And it was a radical response to the utter carnage and wastage of the First World War. And the people that gathered around a man called Tristan Tzara, they felt that the First World War was undermining all of the human values that were worth preserving. And to perpetuate this ruination was a great crime against the human race. They also felt it to devalue all of the values that art had actually represented in that civilization which was being destroyed. So on the superficial level, you could call it anti-art. The most famous Dada exhibit is Marcel Duchamp's urinal, which was presented in a exhibition, 1918. So, I mean, Banksy is in the same tradition of the Dadaists who were saying, look, challenge everything that art stands for, where you see it and what you see. But as long as it is intelligent and creative enough to actually communicate a message to you, like, oh, that changes the way I think about something, then it's art.
So, but Banksy
is subversive.
Banksy is having a go at the current culture, which you may see some parallels, possibly, between the War on Terror and the sort of things we were seeing in the First World War.
There are definitely links. I actually photographed a superb Banksy portrait of George Bush on the eve of the election that he lost, and I thought that was a wonderful thing that he did, because it really did. It communicated something. You know, it was saying, look, actually, this election is important.
It's all very well being negative about the current state of world affairs, but isn't it sort of incumbent on an artist to also show the way, to hold a light up to something positive too?
Well, I think that the history of art, poetry and literature shows that the freedom to protest against the established order is an enshrined right. and a work of art in itself. So I would argue that we can only move forward in progressing human society by people objecting to what's wrong with it.
What about your antiquarian books? Because you also, moving away from Banksy, you do quite a lot of work on the internet, and you're quite an expert. You were telling me before the programme started here.
I'd never tell you I was an
about about well that you are knowledgeable anyway on manuscripts and old books.
Yes.
So how did you get into that originally?
I guess it was always there. I was always, ever since child, having started reading very early, I just devoured everything I could find, old and new. But I moved into this on a professional level around about 8 or 9 years ago, when I became a little bit disenchanted with the more commercial wing of bookselling, where it was becoming corporate-owned. And all of the independent booksellers and publishers were disappearing, which to me is the wonder of publishing and books. So I guess I've retreated into the old in order to rediscover that independence.
What do you think about the way publishing's been going over the last 10 years or so then?
I think it's tricky. I think on a personal level, I certainly miss the independence of the independent bookseller, the independent writer, that are not actually all following the corporate decisions. Because it's about independence of thinking.
And what do you think makes a good new novel? If you were a publisher yourself, how would you be assessing whether you were going to actually put something into print if someone came to you with a manuscript?
Good, clear, strong writing is the first priority. And it has to have, for me, and we can only be personal about this, my own personal taste, it would have to have a slightly subversive edge, but ending up with some values that were challenging and worth thinking about.
So if people are interested in the sort of stuff you're peddling on the internet, whereabouts can we find you?
Peddling? Oh, A.R. Heath Books.
So is there a website?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you just
we have
look
a website.
At that on the search engine?
Yeah, just put in A.R. Heath and you'll find it.
Thanks ever so much for joining us,
welcome,
Brian
it's a
Grist,
pleasure.
Today. Thanks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Part 3 of a 4-part series on spying now, and espionage has come a long way since the Second World War, and hacking is not just for geeks. It's becoming another tool of war. Tonight, we have the third of a 4-part series by journalist Carl Cameron about the presence of Israeli spies in the United States and their links to Israeli software companies and the mafia. What makes this industry so dangerous is that there are big government subsidies for these software companies, which allow them to underbid their competitors. The software has hidden backdoors so that it can be accessed remotely by the manufacturers and their so-called friends.
Israeli-based company called Amdocs that generates the computerized records and billing data for nearly every phone call made in America. As Carl Cameron reported, U.S. investigators digging into the 9/11 terrorist attacks fear that suspects may have been tipped off to what they were doing by information leaking out of Amdocs. In tonight's report, we learned that the concern about phone security extends to another company founded in Israel that provides the technology that the U.S. government uses for electronic eavesdropping. Here is Carl Cameron's third report.
The company is Comverse Infosys, a subsidiary of an Israeli-run private telecommunications firm with offices throughout the U.S. It provides wiretapping equipment for law enforcement. Here's how wiretapping works in the U.S. Every time you make a call, it passes through the nation's elaborate network of switchers and routers run by the phone companies. Custom computers and software made by companies like Comverse are tied into that network to intercept, record, and store the wiretapped calls, and at the same time transmit them to investigators. The manufacturers have continuing access to the computers so they can service them and keep them free of glitches. This process was authorized by the 1994 Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, or CALEA. Senior government officials have now told Fox News that while Kalia made wiretapping easier, it has led to a system that is seriously vulnerable to compromise and may have undermined the whole wiretapping system. Indeed, Fox News has learned that Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller were both warned October 18th in a hand-delivered letter from 15 local, state, and federal law enforcement officials who complained that, quote, law enforcement's current electronic surveillance capabilities are less effective today than they were at the time Kalia was enacted. Converse insists the equipment it installs is secure, but the complaint about this system is that the wiretap computer programs made by Converse have, in effect, a back door through which wiretaps themselves can be intercepted by unauthorized parties. Adding to the suspicions is the fact that in Israel, Converse works closely with the Israeli government and under special programs gets reimbursed for up to 50% of its research and development costs by the Israeli Ministry of Industry and Trade. But investigators within the DEA, INS, and FBI have all told Fox News that to pursue or even suggest Israeli spying through Converse is considered career suicide. And sources say that while various FBI inquiries into Converse have been conducted over the years, they've been halted before the actual equipment has ever been thoroughly tested for leaks. A 1999 FCC document indicates several government agencies expressed deep concerns that too many unauthorized, non-law enforcement personnel can access the wiretap system. And the FBI's own nondescript office in Chantilly, Virginia, that actually oversees the Kalia wiretapping program, is among the most agitated about the threat. But there is a bitter turf war internally at FBI. It is the FBI's office in Quantico, Virginia, that has jurisdiction over awarding contracts and buying intercept equipment. And for years, they've thrown much of the business to Converse. A handful of former U.S. law enforcement officials involved in awarding Converse government contracts over the years now work for the company. Numerous sources say some of those individuals were asked to leave government service under what knowledgeable sources call troublesome circumstances that remain under administrative review within the Justice Department. And what troubles investigators most, particularly in New York, in the counterterrorism investigation of the World Trade Center attack, is that on a number of cases, suspects that they had sought to wiretap and surveil immediately changed their telecommunications processes. They started acting much differently as soon as those supposedly secret wiretaps went into place. Brett?
Carl, is there any reason to suspect in this instance that the Israeli government is involved?
No, there's not, but there are growing instincts in an awful lot of law enforcement officials in a variety of agencies who suspect that and have begun compiling evidence and a highly classified investigation into precisely that possibility. Brett?
All right, Carl, thanks very much.
That was journalist Carl Cameron on Israeli spying and links to software companies, producing video surveillance software and phone billing information. Final part next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
This year celebrates Cuba's socialist revolution in 1959. The revolution brought sweeping changes to the way in which culture was produced, taught, and distributed. Music institutions and colleges were founded and open to all for a while. Afro-Cuban art forms received state support for the first time, ensuring the preservation of some ancient songs and dances. Invention in difficult circumstances became Cuba's middle name during the so-called special period, which began in 1990 after the collapse of the Soviet bloc. It was a time of huge hardship for Cubans, with the loss of most of their imported oil supplies made worse by the ongoing US trade blockade. It meant shortages of everything apart from the enthusiasm for music. Candido Fabre, one of Cuba's great vocal improvisers, makes light of the power cuts of Apagón, which were a regular feature of the so-called special period.
El ventilador
se me quemó el ventilador y a Tita se le fundió el televisor. Y a Tita se le fundió el televisor. El radiecito de Tito también se quedó sin voz. El radiecito de Tito también se quedó sin voz. Y ya no come el frío por culpa del apagón. Y ya no come el frío por culpa del apagón. Apagón, no tiene perdón de Dios. Ey, apagón, no tiene perdón de Dios. Ojalá que se la coiten al ser que me la coitó. Ojalá que se la coiten al ser que me la coitó. De macho, se me echó a perder una chuleta de macho y se le cortó a Raquel la leche de los muchachos. Y se le cortó a Raquel la leche de los muchachos. Si estoy trabajando o viendo televisión, si estoy trabajando o viendo televisión, cuando no lo espero me sorprende el apagón. Cuando no lo espero me sorprende el apagón. Aquí seguimos en ambiente, todo el mundo como el yo.
That was Candido Fabre singing El Apagón. That track was played to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Socialist Revolution in 1959. The next feature is from Anthea Page. It was recorded at the Tollpuddle Festival in Dorset last Sunday to celebrate 175 years of the Tollpuddle Martyrs. But first we hear the singers of the Red Notes Choir, a socialist choir from Bristol who were singing down at the festival. This tune is called Tollpuddle Man.
Don't complain, we are taught, for God is Spencer Anyvane, and I'm in Tolpuddle on Sunday the 19th of July 2009, and what a wonderful event it is.
Can you tell us a bit about the history of Tolpuddle? Because it's the start of the trade union movement, isn't it?
Well, it is really. You see, if you go back to 1834, which may seem a long time ago, but my great-grandfather was born in 1831, so, you know, he was alive. It was... trade unions were officially legal, but they got the Tolpuddle martyrs, who were agricultural workers who formed a union, they got them on the grounds that they had sworn an oath, and an oath was regarded as seditious. So the whole thing was completely cooked up. And Squire Frampton, the farmer, was the man who tried them in the courthouse in Dorchester. And they were sent to Australia as convicts, transported for, I think, 6 or 8 years. And now, interestingly enough, while they were waiting to go to Australia, they put them in the hulks, which were disused ships, as a sort of prison, and they were privately owned. So everything, you know, fear of revolution and all that, so rings a bell today. And when they were sent abroad, there was a huge demonstration in London. 120,000 people marched to Copenhagen Fields in London, and the king... well, and the government had to capitulate, and they came home. And when they got back to Tolpuddle, the local people were so afraid that they would continue to be victimised that they suggested they moved somewhere else. And then 5 of the 6 went to Canada, because the people here were so anxious that they might be continually punished, even though they'd been come back from Australia. So it's a fantastic story, and out of that came the modern trade union movement, and the Chartists, and the suffragettes, and the vote, and the welfare state. So we're celebrating, really, one of the great stories in our labour history, and our parliamentary history, and our democratic history.
So later on you'll be laying a wreath, is that right?
That's right. We have laid a wreath, and then we march around the village, and then we have a meeting. And it's a wonderful event. I've been now over the last 25 years, I guess, and every time I come, I feel inspired. All the trade union banners, and it's a lovely, lovely event. Have you ever been before?
No, it's my first time.
Well, I hope you enjoy it as much as I always do.
I lay this wreath on behalf of the Labour government. Without Tolpuddle martyrs and those inspired by them, there would never have been the possibility of a Labour government. And in what we do, we have to remember at all times the inspiration that lay behind the Tolpuddle martyrs and those who have followed in their footsteps.
Chair of the South West TUC, and I'd like to welcome you all here, especially those of you who've travelled from outside the region, this wonderful part of the country. You're very welcome. Well, it's been no disguising, it's been a difficult year for trade unions. We've witnessed job losses across the board and the devastating consequences that entails for individuals and communities. But at the same time, we've also witnessed, I believe, the best of trade unions. We fought hard to save jobs when we can. We fought hard to secure deals when we can't. We've been lobbying for low interest rates and an increase in statutory redundancy pay. We've called for tax cuts for low and middle earners, for an increase in the winter fuel allowance for pensioners, for a windfall tax on energy companies, and for the closure of tax loopholes that allow the super rich to plunder our economy. We've also seen time and again that we're stronger together. I'm proud that here in the South West, trade unions and trades councils work together and speak together as one voice. It's a strategy of solidarity and support that serves us well, with people from all over the region and from all walks of life joining us this year in standing up for public services, for teachers, for transport workers, for firefighters, for shop workers, for broadcast technicians, for actors, for postal workers, and those in my sector, journalists. Trade unionists, of course, care about more than just jobs. We care passionately about learning. We're passionate about equality, social justice, and the environment. We're also passionate about anti-racism, and I'm proud to say that here in the South West, we gave the BNP a mighty kick up the arse.
Hey, my name's Tim Lezard, and I'm a member of the National Union of Journalists, and I'm chair of the South West TUC. And we commemorate this event every year now to celebrate the contribution of the Tolpuddle Martyrs to the trade union movement. And it's very important because it's very relevant even today that there are people all over the world under oppression. They're struggling to make money. They're living in poor homes under poverty conditions. And that's what the martyrs were fighting against. And I think we need to take inspiration from them because they knew they could have just sat there and done nothing. But the fact that they rose up peacefully against this situation, they formed a trade union, they dared to form the trade union, and they got punished for that. And because of that, there are mass demonstrations outside up in London. I think 100,000 people came. And again, we should take follow their example in that, and we should use that. And when people try and oppress us, we should speak out against it and do what we can. And that's why people here find it so relevant that the struggles that they face are still faced by millions of people the world over today.
Do you think that the trade union now needs to fight even harder for people's rights?
Well, we're down to our last 7 million members, if that's what you mean. We're still the largest voluntary group of people anywhere in the country. So we're still strong. I don't think we need to fight even more now. I think we always have fought strongly for workers' rights, and that's what we're going to continue to do. And this is a great celebration, as well as it's a chance to meet friends and comrades and things that you don't see from year to year. But you meet people from different trade unions that are having the same struggles as you are, and it's very important and a great chance to meet them. But it's not just people from this country. We've got friends here from the United States. We've got friends from Cuba. We've got friends from Germany. We had a big delegation of German trade unionists over here, and they're facing the same struggle as well. So it's important that we look globally, don't just concentrate on our own trade unions, but get out there and become active in a trade union and take an international stance on these issues.
And how well known do you think the Tolpuddle Martyrs are across the world?
I think it depends. I mean, they're quite well known, obviously, in this country. They're quite well known in Australia, and I think they're quite well known in Canada. And then they came back here, and then they emigrated to Canada. So they're the three places that they were touched in. But it's good. I think what they did was very brave. They dared to stand up for their rights. And as a result of that, we're all suffering better rights now. We've received better rights now, because without them, we'd have no trade unions, no limited working hours for a day, no 5-day working week, no weekends.
So do you help set up unions in other countries?
We have done. I mean, well, not so much the TUC. The NUJ has. The NUJ has helped set up a trade union in Ukraine for journalists over there. And I know in Iraq as well, the TUC is very much involved in helping trade unions over there. But it's not a matter of setting them up or telling people what to do. We're just there to give advice if you want and work with our fellow workers who are suffering different kind of problems to us.
Yeah, I'm Ben Bradshaw. I'm the Member of Parliament for Exeter, and I'm also the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport in the government.
And what drew you to Tolpuddle today?
Well, I've always wanted to come to Tolpuddle. The story of the Tolpuddle Martyrs has always been a very important one for me, for my political education and for my sense of history. Theirs was a remarkable story which we should never forget in terms of the importance that it had in the campaign for decent standards for working people and for human rights.
And are they still teaching about the Tolpuddle Martyrs in history?
Do you know, someone said to me that they weren't taught in history, but I remember learning about the Tolpuddle Martyrs in my history. It may be because I did a particular type of history at school at the time that was a bit more progressive, and it may have kind of featured in the history of the Industrial Revolution and the working movement. But I would hope they're teaching about the Tolpuddle Martyrs in history, because you know, it was that they were a very important part of that resistance to the old feudal system in the 19th century.
And how important do you think it is to keep their memory alive?
It's very important to keep their memory alive. It's very important to keep the memory of all of those who've gone before us, who have fought such noble causes alive, whether the anti-slavery campaigners or the campaigners for women's emancipation, or speaking personally for myself as the first openly gay cabinet minister who's always been openly gay, those who campaigned for human rights for gay and lesbian people as well. All of these great advances in human rights and in our history have been fought at a considerable cost to those great pioneers, and it's very important as part of our history and as our sense of ourselves that we remember them.
And it's great to see such a big support here, isn't it?
Fantastic. It's great to see so many people here, and so many people from all over the world who are drawn here by this story and by this historic event, and drawn together by the values that this event and the martyrs themselves represent.
Can you tell us about your band?
We're the OMT Easington Colliery Band.
Oh, which colliery?
Easington Colliery.
Where's
up in
that?
Durham.
We're going to hear the clog dance from Brassed Off.
I think that's it. We're going to get ready for the march. The march we're going to start off with is the Midi. That piece was called Clog Dance that we played.
Can you just tell me where you're from again?
The band is Easington Colliery Band, about 6 to 8 miles south of Durham, in County Durham.
And do you come down here every year?
This is our second year, yes. We've been asked by RMT, who are part sponsoring the band, the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union.
Are they based up north?
No, they're in London, but we do most of the jobs that RMT ask of us. We've been to Ireland, and we've been to the Isle of Man. We've been to London to do the G20 march, and we do this one, and we do in Norfolk later on in the year.
And have you won any competitions for play?
Yes, the band is like a premier band, like similar to the football. We're in like the Premiership, and we do a lot of competitions in Scotland and all around the UK, and we ranked as one of the top 100 bands in the world.
The procession up to the church is about to start. Hi, where are your drummers from?
We're from the Blackdown Hills, Somerset.
Okay, are you a band or...?
Yeah, we're the Blackdown Hills Samba Band, part of the Blackdown Hills music group.
And you're heading the procession today?
We're heading Unison's contingent, yep.
I love it. What do you love?
Sense of history, continuing it. This is history now. It's just a bit overwhelming, actually.
And what are you playing today?
I'm playing the bells. I'm part of Blackdown Samba. And my son has just had his photograph taken to Tony Benn, so I'm a bit stunned.
Can I just ask your daughter for community radio if this is the first time she's been to Toll Puddle? Is this the first time you've been to Toll Puddle?
No.
You came last year?
Oh, yeah.
Do you like it?
Yeah.
What do you like about it?
The music.
We leave the procession at Toll Puddle for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. A story set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. If you remember from last week, in 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to, and he wrote about his experiences in a diary. The introduction music, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Navy Volunteer Pub in Bristol. They meet every Tuesday for an impromptu music session, so you can just turn up and join in.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Agricultural Show Day. This is the fourth we've had, and it gets easier. And in fourpences and shillings, we turned over £75. The first show we had here at the Inn was inundated with peasants and ham teas. There's fun in it, if it wears your feet out a bit. Two women brought their car in, and backed it alongside of the little dining room window, and pulled out their sandwiches and bottles, and lunched. I was waiting my time to tell them of it, when right in front of them a man shouted out to me, "Where's the gents' urinal?" I pointed it out, and turning to the women said, "You've chosen a bad place for your lunch, with the gents' urinal in front of you, and our perfectly good dining room alongside of you. Better taste would have placed you higher up the yard." So they said they really had intended to have it in my garden, and then at 8:30 they wanted to pay 1 shilling for garage for the whole day. After talking for some time to an old woman at lunch, she said to me, "It's a very fine day, waiter, for the show." And into this crowd came Dunstan Skilbeck, bon vivant, jester and farmer, bringing Arnold Dolmetsch and Carr Saunders to lunch and tea. And a young artist, a French viscount from Wendover, sat upstairs and painted the night fair scene without. And an old man with a whore told Katie to tell me that 3 shillings and 6 pence for a 4-course meal was a swindle. And when I went to him afterwards to invite a scrap, he only smiled pleasantly. And John Nash and Dagleish came, and after the beer-drinking masses had gone, so had 6 of my good silver-plated tankards. Walter Payne brought a lovely sight, Doris Lytton Partington, now his wife, to dinner, after which he drew from his pocket a very long cigar for her, and a very small but exquisite one for me. WP runs only 40 theatres. I used to see him on theatre owner committee meetings. In perfect silence, he used to let the thing get more and more boggled, then suddenly deboggle it by 6 or 7 wise words. About a year ago, 2 Oxford aestheses arrived in a car from Cambridge, bringing a Cambridge aesthete of great elegance. The lad descended from the car with arms outstretched, pushing the air, as it were, with the palms of his lovely hands in an undulating motion. Preceded by these hands, he entered the house. At tea I said to them, "I have a friend, Michael Salaman, who is thinking of not sending his sons to Oxford, because he's been told that the moral tone there is not as good as at Cambridge." "It's a lie!" screamed the exquisite, throwing out his lovely hands with passion and indignation. "Cambridge is far worse." "You've altered this room since I was here 5 years ago," said a farmerish old man and his wife, lunching in the distinguished and beautiful dining room. "Do you like it?" "Well, yes. It's clean and respectable now." Humiliating comment is salutary when you're beginning to get satisfied. Still more salutary is a visit to a private house. Michael Salaman's, for instance. A party of 5 people journeyed to dine, and they sat the meal through in almost perfect silence. Feeling that they might blame me or the place for a very dull evening, I went up and tried out some bright chatter on them, but they only stared at me till at last the parson, in as friendly a manner as he could muster, apropos of nothing, asked, "Now, what is your population here?" I replied, "It's not my population, thank God, but there are about 3,000 of them." And we all relapsed into silence again. However, by way of excusing my inadequacy, I might have told him of our grandfather Crawshay, who is said to have had 300 children in South Wales, yes, and with a separate maintenance ledger for the twins. German and Mrs. Morsom came here for the first night of their honeymoon. I gave them roses on their table, Red Letter Day and Independence Day, and Mrs. Morsom had appendicitis within a fortnight. He wrote afterward from Hoyk, "Your inn made all the others we went to seem very uncomfortable." German is centred in his sheep. His soft-faced brother Raisley is centred in himself, and they both got lovely wives. 1927. Past generations. It is a privilege, though one works for it, to have here so many bits of past generations, people one has known by name for 40 years, and some never seen, all being perfectly delightful. Martin Conway, Harry Melville, Jerome K. Jerome, Professor Margoliouth, John Lane Barry, Madame Genet, Miss Horniman, O. Bradbury, Mrs. Colin Hunter, Mrs. Patrick Campbell, Ernest Rees, Nigel Playfair, for wasn't he at Oxford with me? Della Condamine, the learned dandy. He takes me round my own garden, and with that scarlet intonation of the 90s, tells me, or seems to tell me, as much as might John Nash or F. A. Hampton. And they say he performs the same feat with doctors, and I suppose with everyone else's pet swindle in life, and has never yet been found out. Then Vernon Lee, Mrs. Jopling Rowe, Father Rivers, and so on. Why, the list makes my eyes water. And to think that these brave people, though having represented the worst decades of English life and art, should be still at large. It is a privilege to be able to cater for them in their eminent successors of the present generation in return for their own clever tricks. A double privilege, because an artist cannot expect to return the hospitality of a musician by showing him his pictures, nor the musician the novelist, and so on. But an innkeeper can and ought to be able to do for each of them with security of appreciation. A triple privilege, because an innkeeper, being in no aesthetic or intellectual enclosure, can appreciate the tricks of everyone. A joke. David Maxwell brought the young Duke of Norfolk with Ritner and Bob Wilberforce to dinner. Bob looks like a big fair American baseball hero, but is English. The Duke is shy and solid, and I said to him, "We've read a good deal about you lately as being chief butler of England." And now, pouring wine into their glasses, I find it pleasant to be doing you out of your job, for once.
Thank you, Malcolm, and you can hear another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now Jeff Sparks is here to bring us What's On in Bristol. Hi Jeff.
Good evening, this is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday 30th of July, The Grit will be performing at the Beer Keller in Bristol with support from The Setbacks and also Broken Nose. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. On to Friday 31st of July, The Mudheads will be performing at O'Neill's in Baldwin Street, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Rory Gallagher. This track is from the album Photo Finish, which was originally released in 1978, and is titled Shin Kicker. That was Rory Gallagher with Shin Kicker from the album Photo Finish. For more information, check out www.rorygallagher.com. Moving on to Saturday 1st of August, Smokestack Shakers will be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Also on 1st of August, Crawfish will be performing at the King William in Marketplace, Glastonbury. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Sunday, 2nd of August, Fablucis will be performing at the Beehive in Prospect Hill, Swindon. The gig starts at 3 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
So what made you choose Rory Gallagher this week? I'm a big, big fan of Rory.
I just found the CD in the library and I've heard the name mentioned before and I'd never actually heard his music. So I decided to hire the CD out and thought, well, let's have a listen, see how good he is, and very impressed with him.
Okay, so I think you're going to have to be down the library a bit more to get everything by Rory Gallagher, because he's a fantastic artist. Was a fantastic artist, I should say.
He was, yes.
Thanks for that then, Jeff. And to finish off the show this week, we have an announcement from Amnesty about their August event.
Hi, my name is Helen Ostall. I'm with the Bristol Amnesty International Group, which is a fundraiser, an organisation for human rights, campaigning for human rights around the world. We're very excited at the moment. We're about to host our 27th Goldeney Garden Party, which is a fantastic family day out on Sunday the 2nd of August, starting at 1 o'clock, finishing about 5:30. It's only £4 for adults, and this year kids get in for free, and it's a good value ticket. We've got Cindy Stratton playing, who many of you will know is a very well-known local singer-songwriter. People of Note Choir are performing, the Voices Bristol Choir are performing, we've got Six Figures playing, and Jeff Amore as well is playing, so a really good lineup in the orangery of local musicians. And then in the garden we've got some magicians, we've got Pete the Bug Man coming, we've got storytelling, face painting, lots and lots of get fun and games for kids, prizes. It's going to be a really fantastic day out, and all in the beautiful grounds of Goldeney Hall, which is very lucky. It's only open to the public 3 times a year, so come and have a wander around the grounds, come and see the 18th century shell grotto, and have some nice cakes and refreshments in the orangery, and we hope you come and join us for a really nice day.
Finally then, Bristol singer-songwriter Katie Brooks is on Thursday the 6th of August at the Thunderbolt, which is on Bath Road. Those of you with a long memory, that used to be the pub called the Turnpike on Bath Road. And she's on Thursday, 6th of August, and her gig starts at 8:30 p.m. Bristol singer-songwriter Katie Brooks. £5 on the door is the price. That's all from Dialect Radio this week, produced by the Bristol Radio Co-op. And you can find our archive, this week's show, and all the previous shows at www.dialectradio.co.uk. In the studio this week was Brian Grist, and he was talking about the Banksy exhibition, amongst other things. Anthea Page was reporting on the 175th anniversary of the Tolpuddle Martyrs from Tolpuddle down in Dorset. And Malcolm Grieve read another chapter of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. The Red Notes Choir from St Werburgh's in Bristol sang Tolpuddle Man. And Jeff Sparks brought us What's On in Bristol. The studio engineer this week was Villa's Chitrakaran, and the producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from all of us and me, Tony Gosling. See you next week.